So you can always tell, you know, at the last kind of gathering or meeting, as everybody's kind of said their goodbyes, and it's just a kind of chaos before everybody goes in their separate directions. And so during the last hour or so, whatever is left over is possibly some questions and clarifications and what have you. So if you have anything to ask, then please go ahead. So if you have any questions, doubts, clarifications, etc., so this is one area that personally speaking, I don't really want to touch on. But, nevertheless, the reason I say that is because there comes a point where, when one is studying and practicing the teaching of the Buddha, when speaking of mind and the world, as it were, there comes a notion of who is creating and the creator and that which is created, etc. So, generally speaking, we can talk about the pros and the cons of all religious views, and based thereupon, when we have a group of people practicing together, a universally held kind of view leading to an institution, etc., which becomes more cultural than anything else. Now, whether one is born in this part of the world or anywhere in Europe, personally speaking, one is brought up with the notion of a creator, and it doesn't really matter what this is called, but there is the notion that there is a kind of superhuman entity which is the cause of not only ourselves but of everything we experience. Now, there's been a lot of debate over the years as to what the original ideal originating in this part of the world of a creator actually was. And this has been refined and abused in some cases over the years. And nevertheless, we're left, as we find ourselves, with an idea that creation occurred by an entity which is other than ourselves, pulling all of the strings, so to speak. Now, I want to emphasize that if that is your kind of belief, then that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. However, from the Buddhist perspective, and you have to understand that this is going to sound a little bit radical, But this is exactly how it sounded in ancient India, where majority of Hindu views revolve around a similar notion of a creator and creation. Whereas the Buddhist perspective, the Buddha's observation, was of similar to kind of the theory of evolution. And as such, here that's where then Buddhism deviates from the notion of creator. So in this way then, within Buddhism, before you start asking the question, yes, but many of the Buddha's disciples were these divinities living in heavens and having these divine palaces and what have you, these gods and goddesses, like Indra and Brahma would then come to the Buddha and request him to teach, etc. So surely then there exists the notion of God. And here is where we have to make a distinction between kind of divine entities living in these kind of sublime palaces as kind of devas or gods or divine beings, and God as a creator. Similarly, when we look at the word creator, it's essential to gain a thorough understanding of what the term means, because that is not as clear as we would like it to be. Now, as I mentioned, over the years, the original terms which were used in this part of the world have become distorted. So if we take a step back and look anthropologically at the origins of the words for creator, they can be, when looked at from different perspectives, meaning simply that which generates. For example, in the Middle Ages, in Europe, there was a German mystic called Hildegard of Bingen. And she related to creation as what we would, from a Buddhist perspective, understand as the changing nature of things, simple impermanence. What she called it was the greening process. Continual rejuvenation was what created the world, she said. So you had the kind of the creation in spring, summer, then the deterioration, then a period where it was fallow, and then creation would occur again. And this ongoing natural cycle of change was what she related to as the divine. Saying that, of course, she was a mystic and had numerous visions of deities and related to them in much the same way that individuals in this part of the world related to similar visions. But the notion then of the creator for her was of that which changes. In other words then, the changing nature of things. What you might call, in Darwinian theory, the continual evolution of things. So it's essential when we go back to our default setting is to understand what we relate to in terms of a creator. Now, from the Buddhist perspective, it makes no sense to have an ethereal, superhuman individual who has created the world and who is something other than the world. And there are various reasons given for this. And as such, the Buddhist theory of evolution is one that there is no external creator who is like what they call in Freemasonry, for example, the grand architect who is dictating the way the world is going and the way that we are going to experience the world. From the Buddhist perspective, this architect, if you like, is oneself. For as I mentioned earlier, and what will become apparent over the years of our course here, is that the Buddhist notion revolves around, the Buddhist practice revolves around then this stream of consciousness. And within this stream of consciousness, then one's intention to perform certain activity, which is a kind of karmic seed, that then has its fruition, and as such, with the independence of oneself and the world, one creates one's own experience. So then you may say, well, you create your own destiny. But here, the actions that we engage in, their kind of fruition is, again, not destined. It's something that is possible. For example, if we relate it to the simple notion of having a packet of seeds, having a packet of rose seeds does not guarantee that we're going to be able to grow roses. I have a rose seed, do I have a rose? No. I have a seed. If I bury it, will it definitely grow into a rose? There's no guarantee. You could put it in the ground, the seed could become damaged, it wouldn't germinate, it could become frozen in the weather, it could become scorched, there could be a bug eating it, there could be a blackbird plucking it out of the ground and eating it, the ground could become sodden, and therein the seed would rot. Or everything could come together, the seed would germinate, sprout, and we would have a rose bush growing from it. So similarly, and in just the same way, in the Buddhist notion of karma, is whatever action we do, its quality or its color is determined by the intention. And as such, when spiritual teachers give teachings, Buddhist teachers, I should say, give teachings, particularly of the Mahayana variety, within which one's aim is to perfect oneself, in terms of evolution, the kind of the pinnacle of sentient evolution, to become fully awakened, the state of Buddhahood. In order to get to that state, then one is given the understanding that every second of our existence has the potential to be the seed for that state of awakening. And as such, what colors our activity, particularly then when giving and receiving of teaching, is the attitude with which we approach the spiritual practices. This then is the kind of make or break of the situation. So one's attitude then, we are told to continually refine our mind with the attitude to become Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings, in a nutshell. So of course that's just a sentence, but behind that is the whole theory of Buddhism. The whole of Buddhism, if you like, is included in that sentence. The fact that oneself can create one's perfection through addressing one's attitude, receiving then the refined meditative instruction of the Buddha, reflecting upon it, practicing it perfectly, thereby we can achieve then the same result as the Buddha. For the Buddha's teaching is not a kind of dogma. Rather, the teaching of the Buddha is an observation of the way of things. So that's essential to understand, that when the Buddha became awakened, all the Buddha did was to reveal the way to become awakened, so that those who would similarly like to become awakened could, if they like, practice those particular instructions. And as such, within Buddhism then, there's no point in going to a heaven. And if one goes to a hell, it's not something which is permanent, enduring. Within the revelation of the, within the experience of the Buddha, mention is made of divine realms. Mention is also made of hellish types of existence. But these are neither permanent nor enduring. They are temporary. So, within the other spiritual traditions where there is notion of a creator, heaven and hell is linked there toward. And as such, here then, as I mentioned, one has to be very careful about what is meant by creator, because the relationship with that creative force dictates where one goes. So, in some ways, this limits one's option, because one's life is very short, and we have no room for mistake. You either please your creator, and then you go to a permanent, enduring heaven, or you displease that individual, and you go to this hellish type of experience. And both of these are said to, in Christianity at least, I don't know in Judaism, to be infinite, non-ending. So this doesn't really make any sense in terms of cause and effect. If we look at evolution, we look at the way the world works, we look at the cause and effect that we can see with our eyes, the germination of seeds, the growth of beings, etc., through doing an act which is contrary with an interpretation of a divine message, the origin of which is very, very cloudy, is very, very kind of unclear, dictates then where infinity is going to occur. In light of evolution, in light of cause and effect, this doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So as the teaching of Buddha is based upon the natural kind of cause and effect that we can see within the world, albeit on a more subtle level, there within there is no kind of place for an external third-party creator. Here, in terms of one's experience, one creates the causes, and one similarly reaps the harvest of those. In terms of one's practice, then, if one chooses to engage in the spiritual practices which are given in order to accomplish either the lesser, the greater nirvana, or the state of complete and full awakening, very much depends upon one's efforts. One receives the teaching, and then it's up to us to practice it to achieve the result. So in that regard, oneself becomes the creator of one's experience. Just as, for example, when we are at school and we're in our early teens, and then we're then asked, what do you want to do? Do you want a career? Do you want to go into academia? What do you want to do? You create your life for yourself. So in much the same way, within the spiritual training of the Buddha, if one wants to achieve then the result which are mentioned in the instructions, then one engages in those practices for oneself, and thereby one creates the result or experiences the result for oneself. And as such, you might say then that oneself in the present moment is the creator of one's future kind of experiences. It's not predefined or determined by a third party. Nothing else, then we can go home. Oh, the lady asked, can you say something about death? Because in the West, death is problematic, right? And in Buddhist tradition, death is considered important, maybe not problematic, and considered important for one's development. So this goes back to what I was mentioning earlier about recognizing, for example, in Shantideva's book, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, mention is made of three things. It says, there's no time to sleep, wake up, use this ship of the well-favored human existence to cross the ocean of suffering and reach the shore of liberation. So if we look at this stanza from many perspectives, there are three things. There is the person who's told to wake up, there is the boat, and then there are the the adornments of the boat, the rigging, the ropes, the oars, and what have you. And then there is mention made of crossing an ocean. So these are metaphors that are often found within the sutras. Here, the person that's woken up is one's mind. The boat, then, is the human existence that we find ourselves in, which is extraordinary because it has this faculty of human intelligence. And then well-favored means that we've, within this human form, had the opportunity to hear of the state of liberation. And as such, we have everything we need to kind of put those teachings into practice by maybe using the oars, setting the sails, to then cross dissatisfaction and arrive at the state of that which is beyond dissatisfaction or the shore of liberation. But it doesn't mean that the journey is necessarily going to be made in one sailing. So we use this example where the journey is made in several sailings. The sailor who is piloting the ship will make stops along the way. So if we look at our experience in life in relation to death, from the Buddhist perspective, there is this notion of, which we hopefully have some understanding of, contemplative albeit, from our time together, of mind as opposed to body. And if we consider, as Geshe-ma, Kelsang Wangma will teach upon later in the year, there is this stream of consciousness, just as we have a river, there's this stream which is changing, ever changing, just like the river doesn't stay still, it's ever changing. It's momentary, and being momentary, you should understand that momentary doesn't mean every once in a while. It means within that finger snap there were 72 moments. So that's how fine we're talking in terms of the changing nature of things, the molecular kind of turnover, if you will. So mind similarly changes on that level. Now, from the Buddhist perspective and also the Indian tradition, this life that we're experiencing now is this one in a succession. If we look at where, as if we look at the continuation of consciousness, it is that which goes from lifetime to lifetime. It's the string upon which all the beads, like, if these beads represent different experiences of life, that which goes between them, that you probably can't see from there, is this red string. This then is consciousness, the stream of consciousness which goes through these different experiences of life, which are determined. The style the kind of life takes is not dictated by a third party, but rather comes about as a consequence of a previously engaged action. So as such, the possibility for all of us to be reborn in these hellish types of existence, these spirit types of existence as animals, as divinities, etc., is all within us. Now, as such, we notice that cause and effect, it's imperative to develop wholesome states of mind, because those states of mind will ripen or will enjoy the fruit of the wholesome seed, which is something pleasant. Similarly, if one plants unpleasant deeds as seeds, then the result of that is unpleasant, is something which you would like to be away from. So from the Buddhist then, the notion of past life is just the way of things. It's just nature. It's nothing to bang on about. Some people remember, for example, in cultures which are very open to the idea of past and future existences. For example, in Sri Lanka, many, many young-born children talk about previous experiences. Same in India, same in Tibet. It's not a big deal. It's just the nature of things. It's just how things are. But for us, it's somewhere. If we heard a child talking about previous existence, where it lived, we would freak out. Tell it to shut up. because it's something that society in the West, at least, has determined is unhealthy, based upon probably a misreading of one of the popes, probably in the past, interpretation of something, but he's determined that that doesn't exist any longer. Past, you can't speak about past lives; it's akin to witchcraft, and your child will be burned for mentioning anything. But within Asian cultures, where this is just the normal way of things, action, cause and effect is just nature. It's nothing extraordinary. So within a materialistic culture where there is no recourse to spirituality, then, of course, for that person, death is a pain in the neck. You've got the corpse to deal with, you've got the funeral to arrange, then you have the will to determine, then you have the fighting amongst the siblings for who gets what. It's something which we hear about all the time. But for a spiritual individual then, in the Judaism tradition or Kabbalic tradition, but in Christianity, if somebody's a religious person, then they'll try to put their mind at ease just before they kind of pass away. Within the Buddhist tradition, it depends who the person dying is. If the person dying is an ordinary kind of fellow who's not really done much practice, they nevertheless will still, for example in Tibet, they still have the notion that when they're born they're going to die. So there's not this fear of death. Death is just, for Tibetan people, it's just a way of life. So there's no longer this kind of fear and anxiety that one is going to pass away. It's not something that they, have to get used to. Whereas for us, having been brought up in a kind of secular materialistic society, death has now become something that's feared or shunned. But death is just, in relation to life, it's just the natural outcome of life. Just as, for example, when we see during the summer beautiful kind of leaves on the trees and flowers and what have you, it's natural that decay sets in autumn, and by wintertime there's nothing remains of them. We wouldn't think twice about it. It's just the way of things. Similarly, babies are born, they grow up sometimes, and then they die. And that's just the way of things. So when in Tibetan society or in Buddhist society, when somebody's dying, then there should be, in terms of the genuine Buddhist practitioner, three types of experience. For then the advanced practitioner, there should be a great sense of joy, because you will be able to use the process of dying to enhance your spiritual practice. If you don't have such a spiritual training, but you have some notion of spirituality, there should be neutrality, not really kind of one way or the other. But if you are an individual who has no practice, but you've been brought up in a society which accepts the notion of past and future life, or you've come to accept that, then at least there should be no fear at the time of death, because you just see it in relation to life. It's not a big deal. So, of course, I'm saying this within a Buddhist practitioner, within a Buddhist society. So within that society, there's the natural notion of past and future lives, and there's the natural notion of cause and effect. So one has been doing, kind of, as the Buddha mentioned, doing good actions, avoiding negative actions, and possibly subduing the mind somewhat. So the ground for fear has been taken away. But what is the ground for fear? It's a misunderstanding of the process of life and a misunderstanding of the process of death. When that occurs, of course there's something to be feared, because you're going into the unknown. So as such, for the Buddhist practitioner, it's essential to understand that things are in the nature of change. As in the Dhammapada verses, it mentions what goes up comes down, what is born dies. So it's just natural. So when one has, for one's own side, that understanding, then the practice of contemplating what comes after and what comes before one's life, it seems natural. And as such, for us, having been brought up in the kind of materialistic society, then it means taking a step back and really looking at and analyzing what is meant then by the kind of human condition or by life, about what birth, conception involves and what death involves, relating that then to the notion of mind as opposed to the physical body, and then the stream of both, the coming into being and the passing out of being of the physical. But then what about the mental, the coming into being of a mind in a particular being, and then what happens at the time of death? And so as such then, in a nutshell, death is just considered a natural outcome of life. So it's nothing to be shunned, it's nothing to be, you know, freaked out about. Chinese especially are very scared of death. They think that everything, you know, if there's a dead body, the immediate vicinity is haunted. So sometimes, you know, you have a corpse and everyone's, or, you know, like a cremation oven, and everyone, you know, nobody wants to go near the place. They're petrified of it, thinking that it's haunted. But it's just an idea. I mean, there's no reason to think that the place should be haunted just because there are bodies there. It's just the natural outcome of one's life. So relating that to our own spiritual practice, it's essential then to gain an understanding of mind, how the mind works, how the mind works in relation to life and relation to death. Gain an understanding of the stream of consciousness. And then when it comes to contemplating your own mortality, your own passing, the natural thought is, logically, what is going to stand me in good stead so that I'm free, at least free from the fear of dying? And given that future existence occurs, then what is going to project me into a good experience? And thus the contemplation of cause and effect. So these two then, contemplation of the stream of consciousness serving as the basis for cause and effect, becomes the kind of basal reflection and belief within the teaching of the Buddha. And based thereupon, there are within experience, as I mentioned, cause and effect giving rise to pleasant and unpleasant scenarios. Pleasant and unpleasant scenarios then, within the realm of dukkha, this is then called samsara, or then this continual existence, the pinnacle of which is, you know, what we're experiencing now. And then there is the contemplation whether one wants to remain within that, confined in that, or one wants to leave that. And is it possible to leave? Understanding cause and effect, we understand then the cause of this dukkha existence, and we cut that root. And what we cut it with then provides the stopping or the cessation of that dukkha experience. This then is known as the stopping. It doesn't mean that one's mind stops, rather it means the experience of dissatisfaction stops. And what mind experiences thereafter are the varying stages of what's called technically cessation, but what in terms of experience are related to as the states of nirvana, culminating in the state of complete awakening, which is Buddhahood. So this then takes place on or within the confine of the stream of consciousness based upon the understanding of cause and effect. And as such, if you'd like to help somebody who is passing away, then from the Buddhist perspective, it's always good to have a wholesome state of mind. So if somebody you know is dying, try to keep their mind as calm as possible. Try to not disturb them. If at the moment they're about to pass away, if there's lots of relatives kind of wailing and screaming and kind of tearing at the bedclothes, it's very, you know, disturbing for the mind of the person who is about to pass away. And as such, if they really care about the dying person, it would be better, although difficult to implement, to take them out of the room so that the person is there alone or with you, if you are able to guide the person who is dying into then a kind of positive or wholesome state of mind, and within that state of mind then they can gently kind of pass away. So the way that a person passes away reflects the way pretty much that they've lived their life. And so if it's a good person, usually they pass away very peacefully. A negative person, yeah, somewhat differently. So it really depends on how the person has lived their life. Of course, there are exceptions to both rules, but generally speaking, that's the way a person will pass away, reflecting then the way they've lived their life. And as such, there's nothing to be scared of. If somebody's dying in front of you, then just try to keep them, you know, as calm as possible, keep their mind as positive as possible, and then slowly, and if you know how, then guide them into the death process, and then they can die very peacefully. So from the Buddhist perspective, the more peaceful you die, the better your chances for a wholesome rebirth. The more agitated the mind at death, the more agitated that which comes after death becomes. If you'd like an example, if our mind is very, very much at peace and we're very happy, the chances are our dreams will be very positive, very calm, very happy, good dream if you like. Whereas if our mind is greatly disturbed with stress or tension or fear or anxiety, the chances are if we get to sleep, then the dreams, if we indeed do dream, will be somewhat disturbed. So similarly, when somebody is passing away, the more calm their mind, the more calm that process will be, the more upset their mind, the more upset that process will be. And then think along the lines of cause and effect. In terms of going to a future existence, the more calm the mind, the easier that will be. The more kind of disturbed, the more difficult it will be. So if that's your situation, guiding somebody into death, then the most important thing is not to be scared yourself, and also, you know, just to guide the person to have a positive state of mind, and then within that to pass away. I think the problem that we face is that we've seen too many horror films, right? Just because a person is dying, it doesn't mean there's a kind of monster going to jump out of their mouth and kind of attack you, or some spirit is going to spook you. It doesn't work like that. So if you're in that situation, then just try to ease the person's anxiety so that they can pass away, you know, peacefully. Yeah. So, in general, when we talk about mind, so I was using one particular way, using the intention to scan the body. So, intend to scan the foot, think about the foot. Where is this intention coming from? Where is this scanning of these particular parts of the body? Where is the searcher, if you will, the person who is searching out the origin of this intention, mindfulness, whatever you like to call it? So, what is essential is to consider, when we talk of mind as opposed to body, as I mentioned this morning, the general presentation of the world, of ourselves in the world, is of these five aggregates. These five aggregations, these five skandhas, form, feeling, conception, formation, consciousness. In a nutshell, they're two, form and mind. So mind, like the river, we could look at the river from many angles. We can say that it has the bottom of the river, the middle part of the river, the swift-moving part of the river, the somewhat slow-moving part of the river, the current in the river, the waves on the top of the river, the foam on the river, etc. So similarly, when we talk of consciousness, or this stream of consciousness, within that, it has different qualities. What we need to understand, though, is that all of those qualities that the mind has, focus, feeling, concepts, for example, habits, prior habituation, etc., have two qualities, that of being clear and that of being of knowing the object. These two, knowing, to know, to be aware of, if you like. You can use those two terms interchangeably here. So, for example, in the contemplative tradition, when we receive this kind of teaching, the idea is that you go away and you contemplate just two things, mind and body. Now, within mind, there are all these different types, of course. Similarly, within the body, when we talk of body, it's a generic term. Under that term, we can talk of the arms, the legs, the inner organs, the outer torso, etc. So the contemplation is that we contemplate the body. Where is the mind? So we have an intention. I'm going to contemplate the body. That's a thought, isn't it? So where is this intention? That's the starting point. Then we have the analysis. But where is the starting point? So that's what we're trying to find within our body. Now we can talk about having a habit. Sure, for example, our habit may be to, to eat certain things for breakfast. But within that, you know, within that habit, there's always the intention. I'm going to do this because it's my habit. So where does the intention start from? Karma is said to be the intention for doing something. So all mind has within it an urge or an intent to do something. And as such, if we're looking for that, we are simultaneously looking for the origin of thought, the origin of mind. So the origin of thought, the origin of mind, the origin of awareness, etc., these are just terms which can be used interchangeably. So when we are sitting down, the idea is to look for mind. Now when we talk about ourselves, our being, we are physical and mental. So when we look at ourselves, what we're trying to do is find the origin of consciousness. Now, with regard to measuring consciousness, there is no scientific gadget that we can use to measure consciousness. Because according to the definition, consciousness is beyond the elemental structure. It cannot be measured. But nevertheless, we think. So given the fact that we have this introspection, this ability to kind of investigate our being, it's imperative then that given the light of our contemplative training, we find the origin. As I was saying earlier, when I mentioned the book, it's easy to say the mind is clear and knowing. That's the definition of mind, and we can feel happy with that. But in terms of our own practical experience, what does that mean to us? So as I mentioned, clear means two things. What's presented to us is that mind is beyond elemental construction. So we either believe that, or we have a rather kind of healthy skepticism towards it. What does that really mean? And it's better to have this skepticism, because then we'll try to investigate if within my being, within me here, there is something that is beyond the elemental. I definitely can think, I know that, because I'm thinking now. So what is it that thinks? Where is the thought, the black box, if you like, the ghost in the machine? So we then turn our awareness on ourselves and we investigate. So that's all we're doing here, is trying to find mind. If we don't find anything, it doesn't mean mind doesn't exist, because we're thinking, right? And if we're thinking, say, well, I found nothing, mind doesn't exist, well, then what's thinking? So that's a silly conclusion to come to. But if we do the investigation and we find that there is nothing tangible that we can call the consciousness or mind, then it's safe to accept the notion that there is something which is beyond elemental structure, which is within and a part of our being, which is called consciousness or mind. And so it's that subjective alertness or introspection that one is trying to bring to the forefront of one's experience, to investigate then the notion that mind is beyond the elemental structure. Of course, if one finds something, for example, the common usage is of the brain. But if that's the case, then brain is consciousness. But then we need to really investigate which part of the brain. Then, if we're really serious, we'll take that a step further. But we have this disconcordant scientific proof that intention, intention moves the brain and not the other way around. So as I was mentioning earlier from these experiments, through one's intention, or through changing one's mind within the practice of meditation, one can cause the brain to operate in certain ways, certain parts of the brain to become alive and certain ones to become dulled down. So this then is brought about through intention. You determine the function of the brain through your own intention, intentionally engaging in particular contemplative practices. So this is proven. You can probably find the research online on Matthew Ricard's place, but that's a website, matthewricard.org. So you can find the result there. So if that's the case, then in the brain, in terms of, this is a very specialized experiment. It's done with somebody who has very strong practice of meditation. But what it is showing is that there is something which is not elemental, but which, nevertheless, controls the way the brain functions. And as such, bringing this back to our own subjective contemplation, if that's the case, then our own notion that the kind of hub of our consciousness or thoughts is the brain is flawed, because there is information to the contrary. If we want to take it a step further, then we can examine the brain in minute detail, but or we can, for example, go to quantum physicists, read the research papers of the molecular kind of build-up of the brain, within which that which experiences cannot be found. So again, we can do this for ourselves. We can rely on to back up our own experience. We can, if we would like, to take a particular journal and believe that. But it's best in terms of our own spiritual evolution that we find out these things for ourselves. And as such, even though we've just contemplated them for a couple of hours over a weekend, when we were received this kind of teaching in a hermitage, this is something that we go away and you practice for months on end, till you come to a definitive conclusion for yourself, and then you can kind of make progress. But here, the most important thing at the beginning of the practice is to have this openness to the mental side and to the physical side, and then to look for the relationship between the two. Overwhelmed.
Yeah. Because you said that you can influence the brain, but not the opposite way.
No, I didn't say that.
All right.
There's. Okay, this is an interesting point, but here you've got this kind of very, excuse me, you have the brain, which is like a if you like to say a computer, and then you have electricity running through it, which makes it function. So the computer actually works when there is electricity running through it, yeah? But nevertheless, in terms of what you mentioned about depression, etc., this, if we trace the origin of what's the origin of depression? It can be anything, right? Usually it's the way a child or the way a young person or an adult or something happens in their life. They have a particular attitude which is dwelt upon, which, as you mentioned, as in terms of this secretion in the brain, that's perfectly acceptable. There's nothing wrong with saying that at all. And then there's the one influencing the other. For example, if I think on Friday morning, I mentioned on a grosser level, I mean, depression is very subjective, but on a more grosser level, then when we're learning a new skill, like, for example, driving a car, at first we don't have the familiarity to be comfortable with it. And so there's a nervousness in our mind. There's some apprehension about what we're doing. And that lack of comfort, which is purely subjective, is, you know, the driving instructor or, you know, our friend could be perfectly at ease. But for us, we're nervous, and that reflects in the tightness of our body, doesn't it? So here, at that point, you may still be nervous, but you can take some kind of medicine to calm you down. And that nulls the tightness of the body, but the anxiety still you know, lingers. It's not completely overriding the cause of that tightness in the body. Similarly, when you have you've let go, you've kind of got this tightness, and then your mind kind of relaxes, and then you realize, oh, why am I tight? And then it goes away. So there's mutual, and anything. You got an exam, you know, I'm sure that we've all experienced when you have an exam, you have the butterflies in your stomach. So, I mean, you can do something to over, and one benefits the two, but here what we're trying to get to is the origin of the original intention of doing something. So within the brain, the modern scientific view is that the brain dictates our emotions. But here we have proof that intention in terms of intending and engaged particular thoughts bring about certain effects within the mind. Now, in depression, if one has a kind of sad nature or something's happened that's made one dwell upon something which is sad, this is causing a part of the brain which is to do with sadness to overact. And with this overactivity, then this kind of secretion, if you like, is growing more and more. And this then affects, even if the mind becomes neutral, it's still affected. Like, for example, if you take LSD, whether you like it or not, you're going to hallucinate, right? So similarly, if you have this abundance of a particular drug, whether it be one which is produced by the brain or one which is ingested, it's still going to affect your brain in a particular way. It's going to affect the way you see the world in a particular way. So there is this evolution. However, if we talk about the origin of, you know, like Matthew Ricard, as it was called, the happiest man in the world. Why? Well, you have to bear with me a minute. With the mapping of the brain, I'm going to talk about this very generally, yeah? There are parts of the brain which are to do with one's well-being, happiness, if you like. And there are, you know, parts of the brain which are to do with one's sense of worth or identity. There are parts of the brain which are to do with focused attention. There are parts of the brain that are to do with openness, depression, happiness, sadness, etc. There are all manner of kind of rooms. If you liken the brain to a mansion house within which, you know, there are hundreds of rooms. And each of these rooms has a particular function. Now, from the outside, how can you tell if an activity, at night, let's say, how can you tell if something is being done in that room? depends on if there's a light on in the room. We can't do something in there unless it's illuminated. Even if you're going to rob the room, you know, you're going to need a torch light, you know. And if there's a big activity happening, then there'll be a lot of light in the room. So why Matthew, Ricard, and Venerable Chögyal Rinpoche and Mingyur Rinpoche were designated the happiest men alive, and this was in all the scientific, you know, it was considered a great breakthrough. It was in all the scientific journals of the time, and it was also in all the newspapers, was because there's a part of the brain which is to do with your well-being. And they were asked to perform four types of meditation. I'll just list them so you know what they are. There was calm abiding, so sustained attention on an object. It was deity yoga. It was compassion. And it was to do with kind of being mindful, this kind of openness. And what happened is basically it was sat there for however long, 20 minutes, so they get a feel for your brain. And then she's sitting there like, and then the voice comes, please, you know, do meditation one. And so it's calm abiding. So you bring the image to mind and you focus upon it. And you hold that for 20 minutes and then they say, okay, rest. And you rest for 5 minutes and they look at what light, what is illuminated in the brain. Now, of course, we're alive, so parts of the brain are illuminated continually. But when there is this intentioned, there is this intentioned, like meditative practice, which is put in this intention of engaging in meditative practice. When this comes into play, the question is: does this affect the brain or not? And so when you're sitting there and you meditate, are there definite changes within the brain or not? And so the simple answer is yes. So through training the mind, you can bring about these changes within the brain. And the reason why they were talking about these people as the happiest, I mean, everybody who engaged in that kind of competition, in that experiment, got that title. Because when one meditates, there's a part of the brain that is to do with one's well-being. And it's usually when one is, you know, a healthy person, it's usually, if you look at a dimmer switch in a light, yeah, it's usually on about 40, 50. But these individuals, when their meditation was measured, this particular part of the brain to do with your well-being shot up to 80, 90% across the board. Whatever the type of meditation done, when sustained awareness came into play, then this uplifted one's sense of well-being. And as such, that's why these guinea pigs were called the happiest people alive, because this is, again, you have to understand, for the spiritual aspirant, this is a byproduct of meditation. But nevertheless, in terms of uplifting oneself, this secretion which is to do with one's well-being, through then sustained attention, this the effect it has on one's overall health, through as measured through the brain, kind of increases greatly. And as such, then, the intention, but nevertheless, if you're meditating, then it can be quite happy. But the effect of that, you know, is in your, you know, day-to-day life. The effect of that kind of, in terms of our secretion, is going to remain with you. It's not just going to vanish. So similarly, when you mention depression, the reason you're taking a drug is because you're trying to treat something which is essentially mental through its physical effect. So if the person is genuinely trying not to be depressed, then through then the utilization of the drugs and various training and therapy and what have you, it's possible to bring someone out of that depression. But in that case, if the medical condition is quite advanced, you would need both in kind of therapy and also some something physical like a drug to balance the person. So here, similarly, if one is training in meditation, of course, balance is also needed, because you know, you can get into this idea that everything's wonderful and everything's brilliant, etc., but it's not in tune with reality. So again, one has to be a bit careful not to dwell too much in this kind of experience of, you know, well-being, which comes about as a side effect of the practice of meditation. Usually, we can use the two interchangeably. Usually when the word, in Tibetan, which I'm translating from, the word consciousness refers to a kind of stream or a flow. And it, like, for example, the flow of a stream. But every part of the stream, the ripple on the top, you know, the movement of the water, would be considered as mind. So they're pretty much one and the same thing. One is emphasizing a particular aspect, whereas the other is emphasizing the continuity. Consciousness is the continuity. Now remember, my English is not very good.
Well, this is easy. Oh. Unfortunately, my mother passed away this year, a year ago, exactly. And I was studying for 6 months with her, and then she passed away.
From my experience,
no, not the
I wasn't there, and I'm still alive. Usually, you answer a question like that by saying, "How long is a piece of string?" Now your English is failing. It's impossible to say. Is it really impossible to say? I mean, you know, Tibetans sometimes say, oh, you know, you should leave the body for this amount of time or till certain sign arises, etc., you know. And generally, if one has the freedom to do that, it's great. But, you know, we don't have that, you know, freedom. And as such, you know, I would suggest that if you were there for 4 hours, for an ordinary person, that's plenty of time. I would imagine.
Yeah, but I had a feeling that I wasn't done
until then. Then I can't say anything, you know.
But there is no sign that people should. I tried to, I touched her all the time. When I prayed, you know, on the prayer, king of prayer, and everything. I did miss her all the time, and she was very peaceful.
Then it's enough. Maybe it's the weather.
No, so that's why I'm confused about the energy.
Usually when somebody dies, it's said that the most important thing above all else is that the person passes away peacefully. Yes. That's the most important thing. And if you're with somebody when they die, it is said that then, in terms of the consciousness leaving the body. So again, if you can pull the hair, I mean, difficult for me, but you know, touch the top of the head, attract the conscious to the upper part of the body. Tibetans say that's a very good thing to do. But it really depends, you know, on the situation you find yourself in. My mother, for example, when she passed away in hospital, was left in her room for 8 hours. And my sister went there after some time. She said it was very, very peaceful. And then my father went to kind of identify, you know, the body, which was, that was on Friday night, or on Monday morning. And of course then they've taken the body away and put it in a fridge. So when you pull it out of the fridge, you know, it just doesn't look peaceful at all, you know. So It depends on the situation, but the most important thing is that the person pass away peacefully. That's most important. And anyway, you know, it's a year ago, so nothing to dwell on.
I try to stay as long as possible, so the subtle energy leaves the body. So I didn't want the ambulance to call it like this.
Sometimes we don't have any choice, do we? In hospital, it's even worse because they need the bed. So I was asked when there was a man, he was in a car accident, and I was asked to go to recite something. He was in Singapore, to recite something around him. And it's even difficult. I have some precious things to put on his head, kind of some blessed things, but they've taken away the top of his skull. So it's like, oh, what's there? And this is a brain. And so, and then the family requested that I could stay there for you know, 1 hour. And so I stayed there for you know, 1 hour. And during that time, of course, the nurse comes in and she kind of picks the hand up, puts down like this. And then the eldest son got very upset. He said, "Don't touch the body, don't touch the body." And the nurse said, "Why? I've got my job to do." And he said, "Venerable said, don't touch the body." Kind of glares at me, and so I said to him, you know, just let the nurses do what they have to do. It's worse that you get really angry and agitated here than just letting them do their job. And so then the nurse overheard that, and she was quite amenable afterwards. So, but you know, it's difficult, you know, in the West. Everything is so material. There's no time for anybody or anything anymore. It's just the way of things. We have to kind of adapt as best we can. So. Oh, then it's enough. Yeah, good. Well, as you did your best, and that's all you can do, isn't it? Oh, maybe later. You ask professional teachers these professional questions, not idiots like me. Okay, so as we've all finished, and this is the Buddhist tradition, initially I would like to thank the organizers, the Dharma Friends guys, and all the people who made both of these events possible. And I'd like to thank the course organizers and the cooks, and the people who did, you know, all the shopping and the bits and bobs, you know, behind the scenes, so as to make our kind of stay here kind of more pleasant and enjoyable. And in particular, I'd like to thank Tsipi for teaching the yoga. And in general, what I find is that the practice of contemplation is something which requires time and effort. And as such, in a weekend, that it's very difficult to gain a handle so as to be really able to practice things. But nevertheless, we have gone over at least the essential method of contemplation. And if you found it useful, then I would encourage you, or enjoyable, more's the point, to use this method of introspection and meditation, mindfulness, in your daily life. And through prolonged exposure thereto, there definitely will come about a change in your being, as I mentioned earlier. Nowadays, because we are pressed for time, everything has become condensed. So if I take my example, I was quite fortunate that when I would receive this kind of meditation teaching from our teachers, then, you know, we would receive it over, you know, periods of years, not over a weekend. And so in that regard, it's quite, in some from some perspectives, it's quite ironic that, you know, we try to cram everything into a couple of days. But nevertheless, as I mentioned earlier, we have to adapt to the times. But I would suggest that if we would like to have, you know, the spiritual experience of our of the great masters such as the Dalai Lama, then it's essential that we also put in our work. Otherwise, it's, as the Dalai Lama often jokes, we expect the greatest response or the greatest kind of effect from very little effort. It's as if we're looking for the cheapest, quickest, and the spiritual approach which requires the least effort, and then we would like the result of Buddhahood. It just doesn't work like that. Similarly, if we would like the greatest result from investment in the stock market, we have to invest more to get more out of it, so to speak. So, what is essential is if you receive, if you're interested in this type of thing, then this course, this A to Z course, was set up or designed so as to deliver like a number of spiritual kind of contemplations every few months for 9 or 10 years. And the idea being that individuals who would receive those teachings, follow it up with their own kind of contemplation and meditation, would at the end of 9 or 10 years have this kind of a spiritual ability, experience, knowledge, and more's the point, inner kind of subjective experience. So I'd like to very much thank the people who are interested and take the time out of their busy lives to engage in this practice, and also then the facilitators, whether they're here or whether they're away, who make this course available. And if you're interested, as I mentioned, don't be satisfied with a weekend. Try to kind of practice it in your daily life and to expand upon your knowledge. Of course, if you don't really have much interest in it, then never mind. At least we didn't waste too much of our lives. So, as is the Buddhist tradition, where if there's been any kind of merit gathered, and so over the weekend we've discussed the teaching of the Buddha, and we haven't hopefully engaged in too much negativity. And so if there is any merit that comes from this, I'd like to offer this then to the continuation of the Buddhist teaching in the world, and in particular here in Israel, as found within this organization set up by the Dalai Lama, this Dharma Friends. And in order to have Dharma teaching, one needs those who uphold the Dharma teaching. And so our patron is also the Dalai Lama, and also our spiritual teachers, such as Jadro Rinpoche, Gengyatso, Genpenmo Dojila, Gishima, Kelsa Wommo, Anirita, Antonio, Sangekandro, Rabina, and all the other genuine spiritual teachers who come here, come all the way here so that you don't have to exert yourself very much, and share their kind of teachings with you. I'd like to hope, at least, that if there is any merit here, that they all have very long and healthy lives and that their wishes are fulfilled in accordance with the Dharma. And that the organization and the members of the organization and those who are involved actively therewith similarly have long lives, and that their Dharma experience deepens and bears fruit, so that we're all able to enjoy it, enjoy the kind of company of those individuals and the group here again and again. And that's on the kind of temporary level, and ultimately that each and every sentient being, particularly those who are engaged in the spiritual practice, swiftly achieve perfection and thereby usher in kind of both temporary and ultimate peace. And so with that in mind, you do it in Hebrew. I don't know Hebrew, so. I'd like to make that point very clear. As I mentioned earlier, genuine teachers who come here, and I gave the list, and I am not one of them, so you should not include me amongst the teachers. I'm just entertainer. No, I'm not any kind of treasure. I'm like one of the rocks you find out the back. And as I said, I'm just a very bad entertainer. Treasure teaching.